Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Well, Tony, as a pediatrician, I'm really excited about today's topic, the concept and the idea of attachment and bonding and how so super important that is in a child's life, not just at that time, but really for the rest of this child's life as it becomes an adult, is just so vital.
So, Rob, is there anything surprising you've seen in the research?
Well, I think one surprising concept is how new this is. I mean, we've been studying psychiatry and how the brain works for literally centuries, yet the idea of attachment in children and psychology and psychiatry as it relates to children is actually a relatively new concept. It's really only been studied for the last maybe 50 or 60 years. And that's relatively new in scientific terms, believe it or not. But then in terms of surprising studies, I think the ACE study, which we'll talk about in a podcast today, is probably one of the most important studies that very few people have heard of, although it's becoming more and more publicized now.
Right. And ACE stands for?
So ACE stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences. And it really is a list of experiences and traumas that a child might encounter in the first few years of life, especially, that can have detrimental impacts for the rest of a child's life, like I said already, and not just psychological, but even physical. And so a lot of physical illnesses, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, have all been connected in a real way to adverse childhood experiences early on in life. It's incredible.
So yes, Rob, that's why we wanted to have this conversation about attachment in the early childhood years and just how impactful that healthy attachment is for the child, not only early in life, but also into their adult years. Mm-hmm. So today we welcome Dr. Craig Brannon. He has two PhDs in the area of shame and is a master practitioner of clinical counseling. He's had a counseling practice for over 30 years where he's worked with families, and I can't think of anyone better to have this conversation with.
Absolutely. Let's listen to Craig. Craig, welcome to the Smart Family Podcast today.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure talking to you as always. We want to talk about today about the early childhood years and how they are so critically important for bonding between the parent and the child, and also the impact that this carries into life and into adulthood.
Right.
And I want to just start off by asking you, Craig, how did you become interested in this field?
I worked with a lot of youth in South Africa, and what I started to see is that they had been traumatized in some way. And a lot of the old paradigm of the colonial paradigm that children are seen, not heard, and if they are heard, they need to keep quiet. Mm-hmm. And, oh, this is a bad child. And what I noticed is these weren't bad kids. These were hurting kids. So as I visited their homes and started to learn about their backgrounds, I started to see there were some challenges growing up. And there was no major research on attachment back then, because mm-hmm. That's back in the 80s and 90s.
Okay, yep.
But it still fascinated me. And then when I started my second PhD, I was focusing on why adults misbehave the way they do. Again, and particularly in work environments, at home, in marriage. And I thought that has to have a family of origin. We have to go back. And not like Freud did, where he just looked at everything being a problem in the background, family background. But what was it in that person's life? Was there some key areas without blaming one's parents? That's right. Key. But saying that's an explanation. A background is an explanation. And so it fascinated me on why and how a child's development in those formative years, do they have an impact across the lifespan? And so I was talking to adults who would, I was actually talking to, I taught in a geriatrics ward, if you would, mm-hmm. And visited a lot of people in their seniors in their 80s, 90s, and they would often talk about their childhood. And that fascinated me. And I'm going, okay, there has to be a correlation there, but what is it?
Right. Now, Craig, what then in your experience are some things that might derail that process so early on? Because you talk about experiences in childhood as being the key to disrupting this bonding process and then leading to many problems later on in life. What are some things that in early life that can derail this process?
Well, that's a good, great question. A guy by the name of Erickson really hit on this, Eric Erickson, back in the 50s and 60s. And John Bowlby did the same thing in the 60s. What they did, they looked at infants. They looked at what infants would go through. And research has shown, and nobody argues this today, the research has shown that the pair bonding, in other words, the way a mother holds a baby, looks into the baby's eyes, that the right side of the eye, it's called the right orbital frontal cortex, that runs into the emotional part of the brain. And a mother connecting, so when a mother hears a baby cry, so if there's a break in, like a rupture in attention, so mom moves away from the baby, but the baby cries, how soon and how the mother reconnects is key. What else can derail is if, like breastfeeding. You don't have to breastfeed, but if it's even with bottle feeding, eye-to-eye contact is critical. That and then attunement. So attunement would be listening to the cry, yes, but then talking in a soothing way back to that child. So you're connecting. The voice of the mother is another one. So if the mother doesn't have that voice, it's just horrific. There's research has been done in Romanian orphanages.
Right.
And they found that these children would lie 30 long, you know, 30 cots long and cribs long, and they would be changed at 7 o'clock, diaper changed at 7:30, and that's it. Then maybe at 9:30 they'd be changed again, but these kids would stop whimpering, and those staff who would run that would often say to those who would visit, you see how good our children are, they don't cry. Well, there were these little whimpering, these moans. And we're talking about 3 months, 6 months, and babies can actually die if they're not connected to. So they need physical contact. They need that sense of that eye-to-eye to develop those emotions.
Right.
So, Craig, you mentioned eye-to-eye contact with the mother and attunement. Is it a similar process with dads and infants?
They never used to believe that. Now they do. Father has as much a role to play as mom. We've adopted a little baby. So we've had her, she's 2.5 now, but we had her from birth. And I took video of her when I had to look after a few times when Renee would go out, my wife would go out. And this video of me looking into her eyes, and any movement or any facial expression that I had, she mimicked. And I'm talking at 2 months old. Three months old. And then I would laugh, and then she would laugh, and I would go with my mouth, and I have the recording. She goes back. And then I pulled a face in the mirror because I thought, let me see if she mimics that in the mirror. I held her up and I did three different faces. She mimicked every one of my faces. So that attunement and that mimicking is so key, because you're forming what they call the internal working model of the emotional part of the brain. And that runs throughout the lifespan. So a father has an absolute critical connection, and also skin-to-skin contact. Mm-hmm. So not having skin-to-skin contact and holding, and this is an adopted baby, but mm-hmm. she is connecting and she's wiring to us neurologically. It's literally setting pathways in her emotional brain.
And it even would start before the baby's born. I mean, babies already recognize their mother's voice just from hearing it inside the womb.
I've just finished a paper on the maternal aspect of a mother trauma, so maternal trauma in utero. And research has shown it goes across the full 9 months, through all three trimesters. And you can actually create trauma. The baby will pick up on the mother's trauma and literally have that trauma herself.
Yeah, and some of that is physiologic too, because we know that when there is stress experienced by the mother before or after birth, there is cortisol that is released, which is toxic to a brain's development. Yep. And so that's probably part of it as well.
And that would derail. That would absolutely derail the stresses. We're dealing that with our adopted baby right now, where she would bite herself or she would hit her head against the wall or just lose it. And so we've had to work through the emotional regulation, because that cortisol, as you said, from the adrenal glands literally floods the emotional brain. And because the front of the brain is not developed fully, actually until 24.
Right.
So if you've got that infant, age 24, if they haven't learned how to emotionally regulate, and that's why emotional attunement, in other words, picking up on attending to the pain or the hurt or the discomfort or the distress of that baby or toddler is so key. Yeah.
So, Craig, if a parent is dealing with a child who is, or an infant who is exceptionally fussy. You know, sometimes you have a baby who just, for whatever reason, it ends up being a bit mysterious, but there's a lot of crying. Right. How can a parent deal with, you know, needing to sometimes have a break from the crying, but also really attend to attuning with that baby?
Well, when it comes to infant and toddler, what you have to create is these micro moments of that you are a safe person to be there. And remember, because they can't reason, they react. And so often, unfortunately, not many moms can have that break on their own if they're a single parent. But what my wife has found very helpful, and we have, obviously, I will come in alongside her and take our baby, so that gives my wife a break. In fact, I do that on purpose, so she gets that break because of the high needs that our baby has. But also finding good friends that can come in alongside. Mm-hmm. And Renee has two other, my daughter and another good friend who will actually come in. She'll space that where she can have that break. Now, in real life, in real time, that's why the parent must have good regulation, emotional regulation, because the baby will pick up on that. So in real life, so you have times of breaks, but in real life, it's about being that safe base. And the parent needs to know that they are a safe base. They're a secure base that the baby can talk to, particularly as a toddler. Because remember, a toddler explores their world, then they get frustrated. My daughter is trying to put together a Bubble Guppies puzzle piece, and she got really upset the other day. And so, but sitting with her, and, you know, I actually gave my wife a bit of break there. I sat with my baby and I said, honey, let's look for the little one fish. Mm-hmm. Is that the fish? Is that the fish? And she, oh, I can't find it. And she threw the piece down and was starting to yell. I said, oh, here it is. So it's distraction, you know, redirect or go Play-Doh hairstyle. She has this little Play-Doh she likes to play with and makes hair, funny hair. And she goes, oh, Play-Doh. So then move away from the thing that is frustrating her, moving into something else. And a two-year-old, a toddler to 2 to 3 years old, could go to 4 to 5. So we have little working stations, PlayStations that she can go to. And she goes to, actually, she goes to 6 or 7 that she has. So Paw Patrol, Bubble Guppies, and maybe watch a little program, or she does Play-Doh, or she says painting. So having those stations to redirect, because often the parent, if the parent's frustrated, you will have a frustrated child too. It adds to it, should I say.
Yeah, and I think it's important for parents to feel like, yes, we need to be there as sort of that secure base to which my child can attach and bond, but yet also not feel guilty about being able to take a break from that as well, because you got to do that for your own mental health as well.
And no. Saying no at times, or redirect. And so when I say no, it's the idea of redirecting and go, well, not now, hun, but let's try this. And then teaching, because how the parent responds will teach that resilience. You're always wanting to teach resilience. So
what's the resilience? Can you define?
Yeah, resilience is basically like a perseverance that I can work through, and if I'm frustrated about something, I can bounce back. It's not the end of the world. There are solutions involved. And also you're teaching your children right that things go wrong. Life is about struggle. We can't get everything we want and it doesn't always work out. And so again, how parent is the model to sort that out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with that. And, you know, it is so important for parents to feel like not be ashamed of that or not feel guilty about that, because that will also then feed back to the child. And in a negative way.
You can actually, we tried this as an experiment. I came home once with my biological children and I said to Renee, watch how nonverbals affect them. So I walked in and Renee says, hi, honey. And I went, and I had this frown on my face, and immediately I went into the kitchen. Is Dad okay? I didn't grunt. I didn't yell. I didn't. And you create an atmosphere. A parent sets an atmosphere of acceptance or an atmosphere of tension. Mm-hmm. And that's, some research says that's even through the skin, that can be 90% of the problem, which will then put the child, because remember, their emotional brains are full alert and they store that. They can actually, the brain can be in a constant state of alert in an atmosphere where there is a lot of tension.
Right, because we're not talking here about the occasional stressor. We're talking here about constant chronic stress as being that poison for the developing brain in a way.
You got it. Yep.
Right. So tell us then about school age children and how, you know, we move on to that age group. What do we see there? What disrupts the bonding process and that attachment process there?
You know, there's a famous book, Listen So Kids Talk and Talk So Kids Listen. Actually, I saw, Tony, you have that in your library. And it's a phenomenal book because it's about listening. When we don't listen, when we interrupt, when we assume or decide that we know what the children is saying. Also, when we don't understand our child's personality style. There's so much research and practical books out there now on understanding how our children are wired. Are they more introvert or extrovert? Mm-hmm. You know, are they a done right person, just get it done? Are they just about play? Are they, you know, so expressive? Are they about peace or amiable and relationships? It's so key to, and not understanding that, and then meeting the needs of the child through the parent's needs. So when the child is vicariously living through needing their needs to be met, mm-hmm. it creates an anxious, ambivalent child who has to be there for the parent, but the parent's not there for the child. So the idea of not teaching emotional regulation as well, again, in other words, not attuning. I see you okay, honey? You look like you've had a bad day. Or so that idea of looking into but not interpreting every emotion, allowing the child to develop a good emotional vocabulary.
Yeah, Craig, can you say a bit more about the emotional vocabulary? Would you advocate starting to teach your child to label their emotions, for example, at school age, or would you start that earlier? Where would that come in?
We started that earlier. One of the things we've done with our little baby here is I draw pictures. And she doesn't get all, but some she is. Mm-hmm. Smile, sad. She knows those words now by the face. And I do it again with my face. And I do this thing where we can't see it on this podcast, but I run my hand over my face and I'll go. And so I'll drop it, then smile. Then I'll go up and then I'll do. and just like you mimicked me right now, that's what she does. And so I'm going sad. Confused, you know, smile. And she.
Craig's making faces here now.
Yeah, Craig's making faces. I do have a face for podcasts. And that's what I do with her. And I think from a very early age, and then drawing on the fridge. So we have a list of little emotions and like emojis, but they're like smile. So sad, happy, you know, just the basics, not the angry or upset or frustrated, you know, or I'll go frustrated, you know, and we'll just play, but she'll know, and here's the key, giving permission for negative emotion.
Right. Yes.
And trying to understand, because then you give a language to it, and then you do more than just give a language to it, you then help to interpret in context. So Ellie now goes, Ellie's frustrated. Mm-hmm. And then it's appropriate to the context, mm-hmm. as opposed to just throwing everything. You know, put words to that. And it's a great way to teach that emotional regulation, emotional vocabulary, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, which then makes you aware and self-aware of your emotions, and then which helps then to really improve the communication that happens.
And what is done, we also are teaching her our emotion. So for instance, the other day I came in and I went, and she came up to me and she goes, Daddy, okay? That was only 2 weeks ago. I was blown away by that.
Yes.
Because I was sore and I went, oh, and I'd hurt my finger. She comes over. She goes, Daddy, okay? She took my finger. She kissed it and she rubbed it.
Hmm.
It was, my heart broke.
Sweet.
It was sweet. Yeah, so melted, sorry, it melted. But yeah, that's emotional regulation that she identifies. And Renee banged her toe the other day and she goes, sorry, mommy. You know, so that's at 2.5.
Mm-hmm. That shows a lot of empathy already as well.
Chris. Yes, and that's what you want to teach. Any parent, the parents that are listening or even adults listening, empathy is entering into the pain or the suffering or the hurt of another person. You do that, you'll connect with 99% of the people on this earth.
Well, that's what makes us human.
Human, it's because of mm-hmm. connection, right? That connects, that we understand that we hurt and we're there for one another. And that's massive in school age.
Can we just ask one question here just about technology? And of course, we mm-hmm. probably know the answer to this and how this might affect communication because a lot of parents are now often on screens, kids are on screens, right. So obviously the eye contact doesn't happen. Any suggestions or advice you can give to parents or to be parents?
Well, we got to realize that anything on technology, it's only 5% of the conversation when we type something. That's just research tells us that. We can try express emotion through emojis, and that's why they have emojis. And it's interesting how powerful that is. I mean, there's some evidence of some children taking their own lives in their teens because they were disliked and the thumb went down. So they've now moved that thumb out of Facebook now, apparently, or Instagram. One of them have, because it had such a powerful effect upon right. somebody's emotions. So with technology, it's like anything. It's a tool. Unfortunately, it is the number one way children communicate, but unfortunately, it's the number one way parents often communicate. When parents are arguing and they're arguing over text, you're not setting a good precedent. So I always say any serious conversation that you need to have, you want to teach your kids, we have it face to face. So we can see one another's nonverbals, which is about 60% of the conversation, our expressions, and we ask good open-ended questions. If you want to put a couple of themes down that you want to talk about prior, that's fine on a text. But it's never an accusation. It's always an open-ended question. And I would steer away from technology when it comes to tough conversations that need to be had or teaching times. I think that's massive, yeah.
Right, because it's so easy to over-interpret or under-interpret something. But I was also thinking more around how distracting technology can be. And it's great for keeping in touch with people, but it can be very distracting from your role as a parent.
Right.
And that face-to-face interaction doesn't happen anymore. That eye-to-eye contact, which is just mentioned, is so important. Those nonverbal cues, that social communication that happens that way.
Yeah. Right. And I think you mentioned before, Craig, there's a particular issue with a mom who has an infant, for example, using a phone at the same time.
That is absolutely terrible. That's something that actually should not happen, especially when... that's one thing if the child's watching Paw Patrol, and you get a text, that's different. But when you're looking at parents and social media, taking pictures of their children to prove to their world that they're a good parent, that is actually using kids. And we got to be so careful of that. I'm seeing that more and more. And I've heard about it. I don't have Facebook. I have Messenger. But my daughter she's just a young mother. And she said she can't believe how often these young moms are comparing what they're doing, they're dressing. So they're coveting and comparing one another. And it's putting incredible pressure. And those young moms I have as clients are feeling that pressure because they don't measure up. Because they're not putting online how they're failing as moms. That would be different if it's, I'm struggling in this area. Do you have a suggestion? But it's often paraded like everything is okay.
It might be different if it was a support group or a chat
room. Absolutely would be. See, because that way it would have a good tool. Like for advice, it's where one feels one has to compare. That's where it becomes, and that's where technology is not helpful. But again, we've also got to be careful of throwing the baby out with the bathwater with this. We want to have technology because it does have a place as well.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's not the technology that's bad. It's really just how we use it.
Exactly.
And it can be used in powerful and great ways as well.
Exactly.
Craig, can we just shift over to adverse childhood experience? We've kind of already mentioned it and talked about it in the sense of these are well-recognized experiences that can happen in early childhood that have long, lifelong ramifications into adulthood even. Can you tell us about adverse childhood experiences, ACEs, as we would call them in sort of the medical jargon?
Right. And that, interesting, that came out particularly in the 80s, where a gentleman, I've just forgotten his name, he was the father of finding this, where he had a diet
Dr. Felitti.
That's right, yeah.
Yes.
And
obesity clinic.
Yeah, obesity clinic.
California.
And he found out that one of his patients, and this happened with a few of them, had lost 300 pounds, et cetera, but then within a couple of months put it back on and found out that this one lady who had done this did not want to have a boyfriend that she had because she had lost all this weight, wanted to have physical relationship with her, and she didn't want that. So she ate and got back up to that same weight again within a short period of time. And then he started doing background checks, and he found a staggering 70 to 80% of his patients had adverse childhood experiences. What are we talking about that? Well, there's 10 types. We're not going to talk about them all, but reoccurring physical abuse, contact and sexual abuse, reoccurring emotional abuse, physical abuse, emotional neglect, not just emotional abuse, but neglect, loss of parents due to abandonment, separation, divorce, death, family members in prison, hospital or long-term hospital care, domestic violence, mental illness in the family, alcohol abuse. And what that becomes, that literally sets in the brain, and they believe in the hippocampus, which is the emotional part of the brain that stores memory. And so it creates this lack of emotional regulation because the brain is in a constant state of alert that it's going to be hurt. And so it's triggered quite easily. And so the person then looks for other ways. It could be violence. It could be eating. It could be any kind of addictions to deal with that. So, and so adverse childhood experience, they realize it starts within a anywhere from, you know, well, basically zero into teens. Mm-hmm. And it, but the impact not only affects the emotional part of the brain, but actually chronic illness and depression, anxiety has all been attributed to adverse childhood experiences.
Yeah. And again, I believe there's this role that inflammatory agents play, like cortisol and stress.
Again, yep.
And that causes physical changes. And also, I guess, the notion that the earlier this happened, the more sensitive the brain is to sorts of experiences, which makes those early childhood years just so vital.
And so that's why Alan Shaw did a great study on the effect regulation and the development of the child. He wrote three major volumes in the 80s, and he now espouses. In fact, he said people with adverse childhood experiences, if they're in group therapy or in a group, isn't that interesting? In a group where it's a safe group and we're talking, it actually can help right brain development again, where I could feel heard, understood, emotionally attuned to. But he said the challenge is getting somebody to that point because they're triggered by people, yet they have a deep longing to connect, to belong. And so they were robbed of that growing up. So who do they trust? And that's why suicide is on the increase. And that's why I believe depression and anxiety. We're treating depression and anxiety. Yes, it is a mental health, but why? Is it just a mental health? You know, is it an emotional health? Is it a spiritual health? Is it a relational health? Mm-hmm. You know, I think we need to look at it systemically. And I think it starts in the family of origin.
So, Craig, let's say a parent who's listening today sees themselves as, you know, possibly someone who went through an adverse childhood experience. How would that impact their own parenting? And what advice would you give a parent who finds themselves in that position?
Well, unfortunately, we parent as we were parented a lot of the time. But there is incredible research showing that those insecure attachments of avoidance, if my parents didn't emotionally attune to me, or if I had to meet my parents' needs, which were anxious and ambivalent, or I was adopted or abused with adverse childhood experience, normally is a disorganized attachment. All of them have a counterpart adult attachment. So avoidant attachment as a child insecurely becomes dismissive. So now I cut people off. I go into myself. Anxious ambivalent becomes preoccupied. I cling and I have a need to be needed. So I run after rescue and I could be codependent. And then the disorganized can be unresolved in adulthood. And so hurt people have a tendency to hurt people. And some people a lot of clients that I've had can have all three of them, but in different ways. And so is the idea to go back and we have the tools now and the assessments to look at, okay, where did I come from? What was my background like? Let's not blame our parents because that doesn't help because that creates resentment and bitterness. So as a parent say, I need to stop this in my generation. There's an amazing book and I just forgot the author's name. It Didn't Start With You. It's a very practical book on epigenetics. In other words, there is a gene that throughout our family line can carry on. They see there's an African-American homes where there's the slavery. They look at that. Or there's been abuse, a track record of abuse over 4 to 5 generations. But there's a verse in the scripture, in the Bible, that says, though the father eats sour grapes, the children's teeth do not need to be put on edge anymore. And so that's key. So we can stop it in our generation. There's the good news. And why? Well, because we have tools to get some help, some counseling, some therapy through that. And also then to check, to then do a self-assessment, how am I parenting? You know, and not feeling shame and a guilt over that, but realizing we all fail as parents. We all struggle,
right?
And understanding that, and then looking at ourselves, okay, so how is this impacting? I remember when I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. And that came because I went through a ton of abuse growing up and also in boarding school. And when I sat with my older kids and I went down the list of what, and they went, wow, Dad, is your name there? You know, is your face there? And I said, well, I said, this is an explanation, but it's not an excuse. And even though I've gone through this, I need to stop this in my generation. And that's what we did. My wife and I took a long time to work that through. We didn't have the help that we give now, but that helped me to help others and realize, look at my attachments. But then I started looking at my father's attachments, my mother's attachments. My mother was born in Asia, India. We didn't know that until like 2007. She's an Asian Indian, but my father did not want that to be brought out in our home. Well, that was significant. She had her own traumas. So I was able to do a background into both my parents and a little bit into my grandparents. But then I decided that's there. That's an explanation. But now my children, I need to be a different parent. Well, how do I do that? I couldn't get the help. That's why I went into the practice I went into. How do I find that help and then go help others?
Yeah. And just for listeners who may not be aware of the term epigenetics, it really refers to how experiences affect the expression of your genes.
Right.
And so if you have had traumatic experiences, for example, you express different genes in your brain and other parts of your body that can then affect your health, but also can be passed on to the next generation. Right. That's sort of this idea of transgenerational trauma, which we see in so many cultures and people groups and personal experiences as well, as you mentioned already.
They did with the whole thing with Japanese parents. That as businessmen, they would commit suicide if they didn't do well. They would commit harakiri. And they went back and, well, it's the honor-shame culture. Nobody thought to look at it. It goes way back to honor-shame. So if you don't do well in your culture, in your community, you're dishonored. So they were losing money. And Japanese businessmen would throw themselves off buildings. That's part of their epigenetics. They get triggered because they're not allowed to show dishonor. So they don't work it through. They just kill themselves. And that's not healthy. That's not a good way to look at how to work through challenges.
Right. And you're saying that that is a sort of a tendency that's actually
inherited
generation to generation.
In the Zulu culture, it's cutting oneself. So you'll cut your face or you go get revenge. And it's just built in. I would took these Zulu kids when the apartheid era ended. I ended up by working in some schools. And this one young man was violated by and slapped in the face by a white kid. And this young African young man came in with a machete. That's how they deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And so it's like, and that's, and people are mocking that. I said, whoa, that's how his family line, not the healthiest way to deal with it. So we're able to talk him down and we're able to work through a different way of negotiating. And we did, we had some elders come in and we negotiated with his parents. That's how they do it. But that's how they shamed. And interesting, most, in my opinion, most epigenetics have to do with how we process shame. How do we as a culture process shame when we're exposed or disapproved of?
Wow. And that opened up a whole other topic in and of itself, which we should probably talk about on another podcast, this whole concept of shame.
But it would affect how you parent, right?
Right.
Because if how your culture shows you how you see it, shame. So for instance, we were always told children are seen, not heard. So in public, if we ever made a noise, it shamed my parents. But that created a reaction in them to discipline us in a certain way because they were shamed. But that's what their parents did. It's a form of dealing with shame.
Yeah.
Craig, you've talked about how there can be generational ties to reactions of violence, for example.
Right.
How about if we shifted a bit and just ask about addictions? Is that one of the possible implications of a parent-child attachment not being what it should be?
That's a great question. Philip Flores wrote a book in 2012 called Addiction as an Attachment Disorder. Up to that point, the medical model was very, very strong. I did my second master's in addictive behavior and reconciliation, and I believe that it had to do with relationship, and that's why I was introduced to shame as well there, and family of origin. And what he was able to show is that that attachment, addiction was a numbing mechanism not to have to face the shame. So it was an emotional regulational tool. And it was a way to attach in secret and insulate because I couldn't deal with being a parent or failing. And so as a parent, interestingly enough, you fail. You make mistakes. It's shaming on its own because you can't get it right, or you see your kids reflecting yourself. And so if I have addictions, it's amazing how that that failure can lead to addictions because it's an attachment disorder. Or if I have addictions prior to being a parent, I will pass on not only the addiction because as a coping strategy, but I will also pass on an insecure attachment to my kids as well.
So Craig, can you maybe summarize for us? We've talked about so many things, and I feel like we've just touched the tips of many icebergs. Sure. And that there's huge volume of information underneath all of that. But I want to kind of leave our listeners on sort of a hopeful note about attachment and bonding, because many are about to start in that process if they're young parents or they are already in this, just starting on that journey. Mm-hmm. And some have been on that journey and may have realized that there have been difficulties with attachment and bonding. What, let's just go back to that early stage for the young parents that are out there. What are some things that they can do right now to promote that bonding and attachment so that they can either break that cycle that you talked about that may be affecting them from even generations ago going forward?
Well, first of all, try to identify what those insecure attachments are in themselves, because actually knowledge is power. It gives you a sense of confidence. So next is show up. You know, it's amazing just your presence. You got to show up to grow up. You got to show up for your kids to grow up. So the ability to be there, so that closeness, and the child needs to know that they have a guarantee mom and dad will be there. Mm. And that's even, I've been in South Africa away from Ellie, my adopted daughter, for 3 weeks at a time. And yet we have WhatsApp and Skype, and she will talk, or I'll talk to her on a video in the day. And so that's showing up. And another thing is belonging. Help them to know that you are loyal to them. Help them to know that you're there.
Always.
And also, this is also key. There's a guaranteed acceptance that it doesn't matter if they fail or mess up. That doesn't matter. You're going to accept them irrespective. In other words, not only guaranteed acceptance, but guaranteed unconditional love. That they know that they're significant, that, and the parent tells them they're significant. Like this morning, I whispered in Ellie's ear, Daddy loves you. And she turns around, she grabbed both my ears and she gave me a big kiss. And she goes, this is 4:30 in the morning because I had to get up early. And she goes, Ellie, love you too. You know, so she responded because I'm saying, and then when she dropped something yesterday, I love what my wife does. She's amazing. She goes, that's okay, honey. See, there's you're not, who you are is not based upon performance. What you just do, it's who you are, and you're valuable to us. Also, genuine understanding. Not, yeah, no, but asking open-ended questions. Genuinely wanting to understand, to seek to understand before you're understood. That is so key. Do you mean this, honey? Well, no. Okay, well, tell daddy what you mean. And that's key. And that's at any age group. And then the attending, you can attend and affirm what your child is saying. So you can say, so what I hear you saying, are you saying this, this, and this? And you don't have to agree with everything they say to affirm, but you're helping to see that you're actually listening and understanding. Mm-hmm. And here's another one, provide alternatives in a gracious way. Tone is everything. So our tone and how we say something, so it's not an accusatory way, but it's also not demeaning. You know, it's a way that's uplifting, and it's a way that's telling them that they matter, they're valuable.
Right. Yeah, no, I think all those things are just extremely important. And I mean, they seem to intuitively make sense, but they're hard to put in practice sometimes, right? Because we live in a busy world and we have parents that have to go back to work, you know, or who have other things to attend to. But spending that kind of intentional time with your children, I think, is just super.
And I have that, by the way, just for our listeners, I have that on a phone. I have a list on my phone that I check, especially when I'm fatigued, before I go home up the driveway or before I get in my car, to make sure that I'm available.
But then you put the phone away. And when
then
you
I put the phone away. Yes, yeah. So I take the phone in. I just keep looking at it. No. Yeah.
So Craig, you're saying you actually like have an aid. You intentionally prepare yourself to go home and be present.
Yes, because it's interesting. We will do that at work. That's a fact. How's everything today? We could have had the terriblest morning. We'll go, good. See, because we've intentionally, and that's not a lie necessarily, because we've intentionally said, I need to push this aside. Well, why don't we do that with our work? I need to push that day aside because I have a core relationship with my wife or my husband and my partner, and I have a significant and critical relationship with my children. So we should just as much be present there as well.
And of course, that sort of attachment then leads to those children growing up to be the parents that can model that for their children.
Absolutely.
And break that cycle, that cultural, that generational cycle. Mm-hmm. And I
didn't say this in this, is also being honest when you're frustrated or you're tired to say things in a real tone and a gracious tone, but a real tone saying, you know, daddy's really tired right now. That's not you, daddy's just tired. And, you know, for me, I'll pray or I'll go in, get a glass of water or I'll take a shower. Sometimes that really helps so I can de-intensify. And so my wife and I have an agreement. We both will de-intensify for like 15 minutes, 20 minutes. Oh, daddy's just having a shower. Or mommy's just going, you know. And they, that way, we're teaching them that it's okay to go, you know, go de-intensify, go take a breather. And there's nothing wrong with that. And we'll actually say that to Ellie. You know, you can go play. You want to go play, honey? And she'll go read or play or... And that's helping her too. She's frustrated. You know, we soothe her too, right?
Great. So, Craig, any parting words of advice for our parents?
I would say overall, show up so everyone grows up. You know, be there, be present, and cut yourself some slack. Right. Nobody's got it together. You know, no one's got it together. Be in a good support group where people will genuinely support you and allow yourself to fail and learn from those failures, you know, and be that, learn about what a secure attachment is. Learn what it means to be secure, to be present, to be attending, what it means to be safe. Those are, to be a safe person. Those are some key things and anybody can change that. Mm-hmm.
Craig, for a parent who wants to read more about secure attachment to improve their learning, do you have a number one resource you recommend?
I really like The Developing Mind by Daniel Siegel and Parenting. Parenting by Daniel Siegel as well is just excellent. The Whole Brain Child by Daniel Siegel as well. So I really, because he writes really meat and potato. He's a very simple, well, he's an incredibly educated man, but his parenting books are really simple. So especially the one, it's called Parenting from the Inside Out. That's the name of the book. That would be a number one resource I'd go to.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Craig.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we knew that was going to be an exciting conversation, and it sure was. I think we could have talked for hours longer about this whole concept of attachment, bonding, emotional attunement, etc. I feel like we just scratched the surface.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. So I really loved how Craig was able to tie a lot of his own personal experiences in with some very theoretical concepts. He's obviously had lots of personal experience in this area as well.
Yeah, and I appreciate how open Craig was with giving the examples about his adopted daughter and his son. So, Craig, thank you. So you can connect with us on Instagram at Smart Family Podcast. That's all one word. And at our website, smartfamilypodcast.com, where you'll find our podcasts and blog posts. And if you visit, please do leave us a comment. We would love to hear from you. You can pick up Smart Family Podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify or anywhere else. And please don't forget to subscribe. If you love this podcast as much as we love bringing it to you, please share it with your friends and be sure to leave a review.
Well, thanks again for joining us at the Smart Family Podcast, where it is our aim to help you build family relationships that last, cut through the noise to focus on what works, and boost your parenting to the next level. And why do we do that? Because we want to help you love being home.